Good day. Today is Saturday, 18th October 2025. And before I start this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button. If once you've heard the programme, you've either liked what you've heard, or if you've liked part of the programme, you like what you heard. And in either case, you want to indicate that fact. Well, let's now proceed with the rest of the programme. And if Thursday was marked by a telephone conversation between Russian President Putin and US President Donald Trump, a telephone conversation which lasted 2.5 hours and which I discussed in detail in my programme yesterday. Well, yesterday, Friday 17th October, was, if you like, Vladimir Zelensky's day. This is the day that he was in the United States, in Washington, and in which he visited the White House and had a meeting with Donald Trump. And I noticed that there were arrangements made about this meeting which differed significantly from his first visit to the White House in February this year. And by the way, his second visit to the White House in August this year, on the latter occasion, of course, he was accompanied by the massed ranks of the European leadership, Mark Rutte, Ursula von der Leyen, Emmanuel Macron, Keir Starmer, Giorgia Meloni, Friedrich Merz, they were all there. Anyway, this time he came with his delegation from Kiev. They were all Ukrainian officials. But unlike on the previous occasions, the meetings did not take place in the Oval Office, and the media were not invited into the room. And we didn't have this extraordinary situation that happened in February, when the dialogue, the discussions went spiraled out of control and ended up in a straightforward row between Trump and Vance, the vice president, on the one hand, and Zelensky on the other. Somebody, and I must assume it was somebody in the White House, this time was aware that there was a serious risk that something like that might happen again, and made sure that on this occasion, the entire discussion between Trump and Zelensky with their delegations took place in a separate conference room, the cabinet room. And we do have photos, and they show that Zelensky this time turned up in a suit, though not, I notice, with a tie. And anyway, it was perhaps a more conventional appearance than the one we saw back in February. Now, the reason why it was probably a good idea why the meeting took place with the cameras kept away and the media kept away is because there are some indications that the meeting did not go especially well. And in my program yesterday, I touched on the possible reasons, the likely reasons why. In the run-up to this meeting, Zelensky has had every reason to think that when he arrived in Washington, he would find a Donald Trump angry and frustrated, or perhaps more accurately, expressing anger and frustration towards President Putin of Russia, and willing to provide Ukraine with Tomahawk missiles. Now, there's been massive amount of discussion about the Tomahawk missiles, and especially a lot of discussion about whether it is actually physically possible at the present time to deploy them in Ukraine at all, whether the launchers to launch them exist, all sorts of things. I've discussed this at incredible length in earlier programs. For Zelensky, the key thing was not, I think, to get the Tomahawk missiles themselves. It was to get a promise to supply Ukraine with Tomahawk missiles. Never mind if they never came because of insuperable technical problems. Though I have to say, if a promise to supply them is made, the likelihood that they will be delivered is very real. But never mind whether they're going to be supplied. The key thing is to get a promise to supply them, because doing so would be a strong commitment, a clear-cut commitment by the United States, by President Trump, to support Ukraine and to conduct deep strikes far into Russian territory. And secondly, it would also, as the Russians themselves have been at pains to explain, it would also mean the final end of the dialogue, the discussions that have been taking place between the Russians and the Americans. So Zelensky presumably expected that he would get at least a promise to have Tomahawk missiles supplied, and he would have looked forward to that for the reasons I've just set out. And of course, he came, as Zelensky always does, with his maps and his ideas. I remember that he brought maps with him to his previous visit to the White House back in August. Maps which, according to Zelensky, proved that the Russians were not making any actual advances at all, that the whole story about Russian advances is Russian disinformation and propaganda. Anyway, that was in August, but Zelensky came with more maps today. And he apparently showed his maps to Donald Trump. And the maps apparently included various targets right across Russia, which could be struck, which could be hit with the Tomahawk missiles. All of these to be attacked, presumably in conjunction with Ukraine's ongoing drone campaign against these very same targets. And according to some reports, Zelensky offered what I think objectively is a bizarre quid pro quo, offers to help the United States develop drone technology and perhaps even to supply the United States with military drones in return for Tomahawk missiles. Now, before we continue, I think it's important to say that all of this is completely absurd. The idea that the United States doesn't have a better idea of targets inside Ukraine than Ukraine itself does, well, that idea is a ridiculous one. The United States has been monitoring Russia since early in the Cold War. They've had satellites operating above Russia since the 1960s. They presumably have a clear idea of where military bases are located and industrial facilities are located. At least they will have a much better idea of these things than today's Ukraine can possibly do. For Zelensky to come to the White House with targeting information like this is just absurd. And for Ukraine, a bankrupt, militarily exhausted country whose industries are basically in crisis, to seriously think that it can provide the United States, of all countries, with help with military technology on drones or anything else is ridiculous as well. But, well, we're talking about Zelensky. No doubt he's got his own pride. So I suppose it explains why he comes up with these proposals and with these plans. And after all, it's fair to say that about a week ago, Donald Trump did himself say that he wanted the Ukrainians to explain to him how they would use Tomahawk missiles if they were ever provided. Anyway, along comes Zelensky with his maps and his targets and his proposals and his ideas of swaps and all of that. But he must have known in advance of the meeting with Trump that it wasn't going to fly, because Trump has just spoken to Putin. Putin has made crystal clear to Trump that if the United States supplies Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine or deploys Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine, negotiations and dialogue between Russia and the United States is out of the question. Trump himself, in response to that, has suggested a meeting with Trump, well, sorry, with Putin, to which Putin has agreed. The meeting is slated to happen at some point over the course of the next few weeks, perhaps probably in Budapest. That seems to be the agreement. And there's already agreement that the US Secretary of State Marco Rubio and the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov are going to have first a telephone conversation and then an actual meeting to prepare the ground for this meeting between Putin and Trump so that it can then take place. Now, it is all but inconceivable that even a president as unpredictable as Donald Trump, having made all of those arrangements with the Russians and having been told by the Russians that if a commitment is made to supply Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine, the whole dialogue is off, would then go and the very next day agree to supply Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine. So even Zelensky must have realized when he met Trump that there was no realistic possibility that Trump would agree to supply him, to supply Ukraine, or to be more precise, to deploy in Ukraine Tomahawk missiles. And well, that is what Trump told Zelensky. And there are reports from Axios and from CNN that the meeting between Trump and Zelensky, in fact, did not go particularly well. CNN says that the meeting was tense, frank, and at times uncomfortable. That Trump made clear to Zelensky in a direct and honest conversation that for now the Ukrainian leader would not receive Tomahawk missiles. And we're even told by CNN that over the course of the meeting, Trump came away with the impression that that Ukraine is seeking to escalate and prolong the conflict, and supposedly he said to Zelensky, "We're split over the future of the conflict. We have different views about the way forward." I have to say that if it is only now that Donald Trump has understood that Zelensky wants to prolong and escalate the conflict between Ukraine and Russia, then Trump has been very inattentive, to say the least. He hasn't been listening or properly monitoring all of the various things that Zelensky has been saying, and by the way, continues to say. And anyway, apparently, according to Axios, and this is another American journal, Trump might even have gone even further. He might have told Zelensky that the United States has currently no plans to provide Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine. And apparently, Trump said to Zelensky that diplomacy is the priority and that the Tomahawks would undermine it. So, one way or the other, Trump appears to have told Zelensky things which he didn't want, which Zelensky wouldn't have wanted to hear. By the way, if it is correct that Trump did say to Zelensky that the United States has no plans to provide Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine, and that his priority is diplomacy, and that Tomahawks would undermine the diplomacy. Well, then that, to my mind, would corroborate or validate a point often made by Ray McGovern, the former CIA analyst, very eminent CIA analyst and founding member of VIPS, that the whole Tomahawk thing has been basically smoke and mirrors, perhaps intended to impress the Russians and to give Trump some kind of leverage in negotiations, and that Trump has never really had any objective of supplying Tomahawks to Ukraine at all. Once he got Putin's attention and got Putin to agree to this meeting in Budapest. Well, the last is my interpretation. Anyway, whatever. The meeting between Trump and Zelensky went on for 2.5 hours. If it was only about Tomahawks, then this must have been a very acrimonious meeting indeed to have lasted that long. More likely, they did discuss other matters. It's likely that Trump tried to impress upon Zelensky that the situation for Ukraine is not as optimistic as Zelensky and other officials have been trying to imply, and as optimistic as Trump himself suggested in his Truth Social post of 2 weeks ago, where Trump said that Ukraine appears to be winning the war. So one could see how it might have been a very difficult meeting for Zelensky. Now, Trump himself has commented about this meeting. He published a post on Truth Social in which he said the following: "The meeting with President Zelensky was very interesting and cordial, but I told him, as I likewise strongly suggested to President Putin, that it is time to stop the killing and make a deal. Enough blood has been shed with property lines being defined by war and guts. They should stop where they are. Let both claim victory. Let history decide. No more shooting, no more death, no more vast and unsustainable sums of money spent." The last is a very interesting point, by the way. This is a war that would never have started if I were president. Thousands of people being slaughtered each and every week. No more. Go home to your families in peace." Notice the comment again about vast and unsustainable sums of money being spent. This has been something that Trump was talking an awful lot about last year, and indeed before he became president, that Ukraine was costing incredibly large sums of money, that the United States was flooding Ukraine with huge sums of money and getting essentially nothing back in return. And well, we've had all kinds of suggestions as to how that might be changed since then. We had the Minerals Rights Agreement deal that was being talked about so much earlier this year, and which, once it was signed, we have entirely forgotten about, as far as I could see. We've had the suggestions that go back, I think, to August or slightly later, that the United States will stop supplying weapons directly to Ukraine. It will supply weapons to the Europeans, who will pay for these weapons, which will then be forwarded on to Ukraine. Well, whatever, but Trump seems to be hinting in this Truth Social post what is actually true, that regardless of all of these schemes to avoid having American taxpayers' money go on being poured into the black hole, which is the war in Ukraine, nonetheless, The Americans continue to write checks. The money still flows. Money through the IMF and the World Bank, money through NATO, money through all kinds of other ways. And he has not been able to staunch the flow. And realistically, he's not going to be able to staunch the flow until the war itself ends. Well, anyway, Zelensky can't have been pleased with any of this. And pictures have appeared of Zelensky looking, frankly, unhappy, sometimes worse than unhappy, looking, frankly, frustrated, upset, very angry on occasion. It's not perhaps entirely fair to draw too many conclusions from photos of this kind, but anyway, the long and the short of it is that none of the pictures that have hit of him that I have seen suggest a happy, confident, radiant Zelensky or anything like that. The meeting, from his point of view, cannot have gone, did not go especially well. So anyway, that is Zelensky's meeting with Trump. Directly after the meeting with Trump, Zelensky did what he always does. He called his friends in Europe. He had a conversation with them. It's not clear who exactly this time was in on the call. I get the impression, perhaps far from all of the European leaders were this time. No doubt, doubtless, he got the continued verbal support that he was expecting. The Germans apparently made clear that they were supporting. But anyway, it can't have made up for the disappointment of his meeting with Donald Trump. Now, that's all very interesting, and as I said, I've spent some time discussing it. I'm going to turn later to the situation on the front lines, and I'm going to suggest that what is going on the front li going on in the front lines, going on in the sky, must for Zelensky be arguably at least as depressing as his encounter with Trump. In fact, I'm going to suggest that for Zelensky, it is the crisis on the front lines, which is probably at the forefront of his mind at the moment. He was perhaps therefore especially seeking some comfort and support from Trump, and it will have come as a particular blow to him that he didn't receive it. Anyway, Zelensky did say, nonetheless, a number of interesting things. He said that he was still hoping for military support from the United States. He appeared to think that the topic of the Tomahawks has not been entirely closed. By the way, he's right about that. I don't think that Trump actually said to Zelensky that the United States is not going to supply Ukraine with Tomahawk missiles ever. As is always the case with Trump, he didn't just slam the door on this bad idea shut. He still left it slightly open, which I suspect will cause problems for Trump himself in the future. But more interesting for me was what Zelensky said about Putin, about the fact that Putin hated him and that he hates Putin. Now, I have never heard Putin himself say that he hates Zelensky. And Zelensky complained or appeared to complain that Putin is trying to kill him. But I have never seen the slightest evidence that this is so. And as I've discussed in many programs, if Putin really wanted Zelensky dead, he could have achieved that many times over. There were many, many occasions when Zelensky was in the Russians' sights. And I would add that Putin, of course, himself has actually said in the past and in the relatively recent past that one of the reasons he doesn't see any value in killing Zelensky, quite apart from ethical considerations and political ones, is that Zelensky is an irrational actor, that he makes constantly bad decisions, particularly on the battlefronts, that these bad decisions work always and invariably to Russia's advantage. And given that that is so, it doesn't make any sense for Russia to eliminate Zelensky when there is a very real possibility that the person who succeeds Zelensky in that case might be a much more capable leader than Zelensky, and one who would cause the Russians further problems. But anyway, Zelensky spoke about Putin's hatred of him and of Putin trying to eliminate him, and Zelensky said that he, for these and other reasons, also hates Putin. Now, I have to say, this admission is an interesting and important admission on any logical basis, or to disqualify Zelensky from being the leader of Ukraine in this difficult hour. Because any leader of Ukraine who took an objective view of the situation would see that it is critical. Ukraine is being hammered in the sky. It is losing the war in the sky. There is no doubt or question about this. Ukraine has no means to counter the Russian offensive in the sky. The West has run out of its ability to provide Ukraine with air defense systems. The United States, worried about the state of its Patriot missile stockpiles, is no longer supplying them in to any great extent. And the Ukrainians themselves, anyway, have now admitted that these Patriot missiles are not effective against the Russian missiles that are being launched against Ukraine. As we will see shortly, the situation on the battlefronts is disastrous, and it is approaching what could very well turn out to be a terminal crisis for Ukraine's ability to continue the war. And, well, Zelensky has now had a meeting with Donald Trump in the Oval Office. Trump represents the country, the United States, which is the only country in any position to provide Ukraine with military and economic support. As we have repeatedly seen, the Europeans, either individually or collectively, are unable to do so. Anybody who looks at European assistance to Ukraine, monetary and above all military, would be embarrassed by Europe's inability to provide Ukraine with the kind of support that the Ukrainians have come to expect. Anyway, Zelensky has just had a meeting with this leader, with Trump, the leader, as I said, of the only country able to provide the Ukrainians, Ukraine, with some of the assistance that Zelensky, Ukraine, have been asking for. And Zelensky has seen that meeting fall far short of his expectations. Objectively, Ukraine is looking at a disastrous situation, a situation where there is no way out other than negotiations with the Russians. And what does the president of this country say? He hates the leader of Russia, the leader on the other side, the man he needs to negotiate with. Zelensky continues to demand a ceasefire, as he did again yesterday. He continues to say that he's prepared to meet Putin in any place and in any location and without preconditions, any location except Russia or Belarus. But at the same time, he says that he hates President Putin. How can there be an effective, a successful negotiation if the Ukrainians are led by someone who admits to this personal antipathy of the leader of the other side? So I don't su expect Zelensky to understand or follow this logic. He's no doubt going to cling on and remain president of Ukraine no matter what. But his admission that he hates Putin is, in effect, an admission that he will never negotiate a reasonable end to this war, a reasonable or perhaps realistic end to this war. Temperamentally, emotionally, he is incapable of doing it. And of course, as I've discussed in many programs, his interests are against him doing it also. Anyway, where does that leave us? Now, there is still discussions about this summit meeting that is due to take place between Putin and Trump, perhaps in 2 weeks' time. And it seems definite now that the meeting will take place in Budapest. I should say that I've had a lot of people writing to me with information about the lead up to this summit meeting. I've had emails from people like Ray McGovern and Jeff Roberts and others who provided me not just with their views, but also with extremely valuable information itself. I should also mention Robert Barnes, who's done the same. And this is information from the Russian side, from the American side, from all of that. And I've also myself been going through the various statements and comments that have been made by Putin and other Russian officials since the meeting in Alaska, and which touches on what happened at that meeting in Alaska. And well, what I'm now going to say should be taken as my views, shaped obviously by the information that these people have provided. But let me stress again, it is my views and my opinions about what happened, what took place in Alaska, and what's taken place since. And it is briefly this: the Russians in Alaska thought they had come to some kind of understanding with Donald Trump, an understanding both about how to navigate an end to the conflict in Ukraine, but also an understanding about larger matters as well, economic relations between Russia and the United States, of course, but probably looking forward to discussing the security architecture of Europe. And it's clear that the Russians came with various proposals, and I have come to the view that these proposals about the Ukrainian conflict were fairly substantive, more substantive than perhaps I had realized in earlier programs. They are essentially Istanbul plus, but the proposals probably did contain elements of flexibility about them too. And the Russians came away with the impression, and probably rightly came away with the impression, that Donald Trump said to them that he was interested in these proposals. He thought that these were workable proposals, or at least proposals that could be worked on, that he would go back to Washington, that he would consult with the officials there, the other officials there, and with the Ukrainians, obviously, and with the Europeans also. And that in due course, in time, he would come back and tell the Russians his formal response. And this is the reason why the meeting in Alaska, in Anchorage, lasted just 1.5 hours. It's not because Trump became furious because Putin gave him a history lecture, as that deeply manipulative article in the Financial Times, which was published yesterday, implies. It was because the Russians had prepared a proposal, and it was agreed that Trump would go away and would consult about it and would contact the Russians about it again. The Russians saw Alaska, in other words, as the beginning of a substantive dialogue about Ukraine and the conflict there and about other matters, and were expecting that Trump would revert to them and that there would be another step forward in that process. It reminds me a little of what happened in Istanbul in April 2022, when the Russians initialed what they thought was an agreement with the Ukrainians and agreed with the Ukrainians that there would be various proposals made by the Russians to improve on Istanbul, and the Ukrainians said that they would come back and respond to the Russian proposals, only, of course, they never did. And exactly the same thing has happened, because as Russian officials, Lavrov especially, have made clear, the Russians made their proposals, made their suggestions. The Americans went away. Trump went away. And the days have turned into weeks, and the weeks have turned into months. And Trump and the Americans have never come back with a substantive response to the Russian suggestions. And what we have had instead is meetings between Trump and Zelensky, meetings between Trump and the Europeans, telephone calls and video conferences between Trump and the Europeans. We've had talk about security guarantees, about deployments of European peacekeepers to Ukraine. We've had talk about sanctions, further sanctions on Russia, talk about the United States imposing tariffs on Russia's trading partners if they continue to buy Russian oil, claims about things that Prime Minister Modi of India says, which he is supposed to have said, which he, as we will, as I will discuss shortly, definitely did not say. And ultimately, it all evolved into this discussion about the United States providing Ukraine with Tomahawk missiles. And at that point, that was the moment when the Russians basically had enough and started to make clear to the Americans that this was just going too far. They'd not received any substantive proposals. They were insisting that they must now receive substantive proposals. And the Russians set down the final marker. They said to the Americans, look, if you're going to go ahead and talk about Tomahawk missiles and give Tomahawk missiles to the Ukrainians, then there's no point in discussing Alaska any further. It's over. We'll just go ahead and win the war. And, well, the whole process of negotiation, of discussion, not just about Ukraine, but about all the other things, is ended as well. And I think that the call that took place on Thursday between Putin and Trump was intended by the Russians to make that crystal clear to Trump. And I don't think that the Russians expected or intended that the call would result in Trump coming back and proposing another summit meeting. In fact, Ushakov's briefing shows that that was not what the Russians expected at all, and that they were taken by surprise when Trump proposed another summit meeting and did not, in fact, agree to another summit meeting over the course of the telephone call. But subsequently, afterwards, perhaps after hearing from Prime Minister Orbán of Hungary, and perhaps after getting more assurances from the Americans, the Russians have agreed to this meeting in order to see whether this process, which is on the brink of collapse, has any prospect of being taken further forward. And, well, I would add that from a Russian point of view, Trump's decision yesterday to reject the proposed Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine was probably a welcome step, but ultimately a small one. What the Russians will no doubt be asking Trump when Putin and Trump meet in Budapest is, look, we set out our ideas when we met in Alaska. You told us what your response was going to be. It's time we now had one. Now, many people are very frustrated by this. They say, why is Putin continuing to continue with this process? Doesn't he realize that Trump discussions with Trump ultimately are going to lead nowhere? And undoubtedly, there are many Russians in Moscow who are saying this too. But, well, what I will say is this: this is a war. People are dying. Yes, the Russians are winning. But I, for one, would be very, very slow to criticize anyone in the middle of a war of this kind, where victory, either for the Russians, well, definitely for the Russians, would have long-term implications about international security and international stability. I myself would be very slow to criticize any attempt to try to keep some kind of dialogue going. I, after all, have been suggesting that the Western powers be realistic and try to engage the Russians in negotiations since basically the moment when the war began. And it seems to me that Putin, at least, is exhibiting the same sort of underlying realism in trying to speak to the Americans as well. But it can only go so far, and I think we are almost at that point now when, unless there is real movement forward in Budapest, this isn't going to go any further. The Russians are very frustrated and angry about what has happened since Alaska. They feel that Trump has wasted an enormous amount of time speaking to the Europeans and to the Ukrainians and to the hardliners in his own administration, that he seems to follow their guidance far too often. They're undoubtedly incensed by some of the things that he has said about them. And frankly, I don't myself think that if there is no, I myself think that if there is no substantive progress in Budapest, this time it really will probably be finally and conclusively over. One of the reasons I think that is because the actual situation on the front lines or in the war is very different now from what it was when Trump and Zelensky met in Alaska. Yes, the Russians were advancing. Yes, the Russians had just driven the Ukrainians out of Kursk region in a catastrophic defeat for the Ukrainians. But the Russians in August were not on the brink of capturing Pokrovsk or of encircling huge numbers of Ukrainian troops. The Russians were not on the brink of capturing Kupiansk and encircling huge numbers of Ukrainian troops there. The Russians had not yet broken into Konstantinivka. They had not crossed the Dnieper and taken positions perhaps in the city of Kherson itself. The Ukrainian army was still in a better position than it is in today. And the war in the air that was clearly going in Russia's direction had not reached the point of crisis that it has now. In addition, there had not been, in August, this extraordinary, catastrophic deterioration in relations between the United States and China that we have seen over the last few weeks. As I discussed recently, China has now imposed very strong restrictions on the exports of rare earths. As the French commentator and businessman Arnaud Bertrand has pointed out in a very powerful piece on his Substack blog, the response from the United States has been essentially panic. They understand fully that they cannot replace Chinese rare earths, that it cannot be done. The extraordinary mix of threats and demands that we've had from people like Scott Bessent, and by the way, the President of the United States, Donald Trump himself, shows the extent to which the Americans understand that they are playing this game of poker with the Chinese without any strong cards. Arnaud Bertrand, in a follow-up post, has also pointed out that the one lever that the Americans had over the Chinese, which was the export of helium to China, which the Chinese needed for refining some of these rare earths, that has been lost because, unlike the United States, China has developed its own production of helium and has obtained its own sources of helium. And by the way, and for the record, I happen to know that one of the major producers of helium is, surprise to surprise, Russia. And I expect that all kinds of deals on that have been done. Anyway, the key thing is that the Russians now know for sure that their relations with China are fully stable and fully secure. That the relationship between China is there for the long term, that the Chinese need them just as they need China, and that each of these two countries fully has the other's back. If there'd been any doubts about this before, there are none now. So the Russians are in a much stronger position today than they were in August. And it might not be easy to persuade the Russians, even to revert back to whatever suggestions it was that the Russians were making in August, because the situation today has moved, changed, and become so much more favourable to themselves. So it's far from certain that any progress between the Americans and the Russians can take place in Budapest. And if there is no progress, it's difficult to see that this process of negotiations, at least on the Ukrainian issues, can move forward at all. And it is very unlikely, by the way, that there is going to be any progress on the Ukrainian issue at all. And there is a very simple reason for this, and that goes back to Zelensky. I said that temperamentally and emotionally and because of his own interests, Zelensky is unable to negotiate a peace with the Russians. And every comment, every statement made by European officials over the last few weeks and months, ever since Alaska and beyond, shows that the Europeans remain implacably hostile to any settlement of the conflict in Ukraine. As they have said themselves, better a continuation of the war than a bad peace. What they construe as a bad peace being one which addresses what the Russians call the root causes of the war. Better, in fact, to see Ukraine destroyed or overrun completely by the Russians than to have a situation where the Americans and the Russians do a deal, the Russians get their core interests in Ukraine satisfied, and the Russians and the Americans are able to move forward with a detente or even a rapprochement, which might cause the United States to scale down its involvement in Europe. So, given the array of these forces, the Europeans and the Ukrainians, and given the support that these forces have in the United States itself, it's very difficult to see how a process to settle the Ukraine war can take place. At the very least, doing that would require Trump to cut his ties to the hardliners within his administration, people like General Kellogg, and that, of course, is something that he has consistently shown that he is not prepared to do. So as of today, I have to say this, it seems to me that the prospects of this meeting in Budapest are far from good. One can see this, by the way, in the way that the media are covering the summit, this coming summit in Budapest. When the Alaska summit was announced back in July, August, the European media were in shock. European governments were furious. There was enormous amount of commentary and discussion and alarm expressed right across the media in Europe and on the part of the neocon media in the United States. This time there is nothing like that. There is no sense this time of alarm or worry about the meeting between Putin and Trump in Budapest, because the Europeans no longer believe that Trump has the political strength or the political will to cut the deal with Putin that the Europeans were afraid he might do just a few months ago. So there it is. That's my assessment. Now, just to finish on this, there is one strange thing that has happened over the course of this last week, which perhaps highlights how difficult, how impossible, in fact, it is for the Russians to do a deal with Trump at all, and perhaps to rely on that deal and to say to themselves that this is really going to work out. Because Trump recently, just a couple of days ago, said that he'd had a conversation, a telephone conversation with Prime Minister Modi of India, and that Prime Minister Modi promised him that India would stop buying Russian oil and would only return to buying Russian oil after the war in Ukraine had ended. I've pointed out that it is most unlikely indeed that Modi would say anything like that to Trump over the course of a telephone call. And in a recent program, I also pointed out that the foreign ministry spokesman in India appeared to be very politely contradicting what Trump was saying. What I have since been told is that not only did Modi never say anything like that over the course of a telephone conversation with Trump, but there has been no recent telephone conversation between Modi and Trump. There was a conversation a little while back, when Trump telephoned Modi on the occasion of Modi's birthday. Putin, by the way, also spoke to Modi on the same day. But there was no word at that time of Modi making any such promise. And it's, as I said already, it's unlikely that he would have done. And besides, the way Trump described it, it appeared as if the call between himself and Modi had only just happened. So anyway, this is already very strange. I mean, it rather implies that the President of the United States is inventing a telephone conversation with the Prime Minister of India, which never took place. But over the last couple of hours, the United States has actually claimed that India has reduced its purchases of Russian oil by half. Reuters, the British news agency, has checked this information and cannot find any evidence that it is so. And in fact, apparently, the owners and operators of Indian oil refineries and purchasers of Russian oil have come back and said that they've received no guidance from the Indian government that they should stop buying Russian oil. Now, a guy that behaves like this, that comes up with what on the face of it looks like a fairy tale, is not a government with which perhaps you should expect very much from negotiations. Some would say that it's not a government with which you should be negotiating at all. And I can myself understand that. The Russians probably would say that given the power of the United States, they have no realistic choice. But I suspect others in Moscow are pushing back and saying otherwise. Anyway, that's enough of the negotiations. Let's now talk about the situation on the front lines, which is taking, as I said, an ever more dramatic turn. The first thing to say is that the Russians have again been pounding Ukraine from the skies. Russian drones, Garand drones, Russian missiles continue to blast positions across Ukraine. There doesn't seem to be any reduction or stepping back from the war in the sky by the Russians. And in fact, there was another big missile and drone strike over the course of last night. And I believe that there was another big missile and drone strike from across Ukraine the night before. I am not up to date with the details of the effects of these missile and drone strikes, these latest Russian missile and drone strikes. But I have every reason to believe that they were every bit as devastating as all of the others. And the key thing, again, is that there is no sign, no evidence that Ukraine's air defense is able to counter these Russian missile strikes and drone strikes in any effective way. Over the last 3 months, the fiction, I suspect it was a fiction for much longer, the fiction that Ukraine has an effective air defense is disintegrating. I read recently that the Russians dropped a FAB bomb, an aircraft bomb, apparently on the city of Nikolaev, which is located just east of Odessa. The Ukrainians are claiming that this bomb was launched, it's a glide bomb, was launched by a Russian aircraft flying at a distance 150 kilometers from the target, which would mean place it somewhere over Crimea. Well, that's possible, and it's well known that the Russians have been working on developing and improving their glide bomb technology all the time, and that it is indeed becoming increasingly sophisticated. But I wonder whether another possible thing that might have happened is that this Russian aircraft that launched this glide bomb came much closer to Nikolaev than the Ukrainians want to admit, and that the Russians feel able to operate closer to Nikolaev because the Ukrainian air defense has, to all intents and purposes, now entirely collapsed. Anyway, let's talk about the situation on the front lines, because there has in fact been dramatic developments over the last 2 days. Firstly, there is now a big cluster of reports that the Russians have crossed the Dnieper and have occupied parts of the city of Kherson on the west bank of the Dnieper, as well as various adjoining islands and other positions on the Dnieper's west bank. Now, I am seeing no visual proof that these reports are true, and I have to say, when I first heard them, I was deeply skeptical about them. We are, after all, in autumn. It is the time of the autumn rains and of the Rasputitsa. Weather conditions apparently are rather cold, and I would have thought this is just about the worst time of the year to try to conduct an operation to land troops on the other bank of a wide river, and do so against likely hostile opposition on the other bank. It all seems very extraordinary that the Russians would try such a thing at this time. But the reports that it is happening are accumulating, they're getting stronger. And whilst I still have my doubts that things are quite as dramatic as is being claimed, and that the Russians really have captured or recaptured part of the city of Kherson, well, the accumulation of reports is now so strong that, well, maybe there is some truth. I will wait to see what the Russian Defense Ministry and perhaps Radovka say about this. So far, neither has said anything which makes me wonder the extent to which these reports could be true. If they are true, by the way, it would suggest that Ukraine has stripped its forces in Kherson region, that the Russians probably have decided that the defense in this area, the Ukrainian defense, has completely broken down, and that the path to advance is wide open, and that this is the correct and proper moment to take advantage of that fact, and perhaps to oblige the Ukrainians to stretch their lines again. But as I said, let's not jump ahead and assume that all these reports necessarily are true. But as I said, they are accumulating and they are becoming more detailed. And I have to say, it does remind me a little of the early reports of big Russian breakthroughs in Pokrovsk and northeast of Pokrovsk that started to circulate it in August. And I was similarly skeptical of those reports when they started to appear, except, of course, that they turned out to be true. Now, anyway, that's the situation in Kherson. I would say that if the Russians do re-establish positions in the city of Kherson, if they recapture the city of Kherson, then, of course, it is a massive military crisis for Ukraine. It would highlight the fact that Ukraine unequivocally is indeed losing the war and no longer has enough troops to defend the front line. And it would also mean, it would further mean, that the Russian negotiating position in any dealings with the Americans would be much stronger, is much stronger now than it was back in August. So anyway, that's the first thing to say. There are these reports about the situation in Kherson region. There are also reports that Ukrainian resistance in eastern Zaporozhye is now collapsing. There have been some reports that the Russians yesterday captured in full the village of Poltavka. These reports apparently are backed by video footage, which, by the way, I have not seen. So I don't know whether this is true. But anyway, again, the accumulation of reports this time about the fall of Poltavka is becoming very strong. And it may be that Poltavka has indeed fallen, in which case the adjoining village of Uspenivka is likely to fall as well. The Russians seem to be in the process of encircling the village of Velikomikhailovka a little further to the north. If all of these villages fall, or indeed if even one of them falls, the Russians can cut the road, the supply roads to the city of Guliapolye to the south. Guliapolye and Orekhov are the two important remaining towns under Ukrainian control in Zaporozhye region, other than the city of Zaporozhye itself. It's widely acknowledged that if Guliapolye falls, with the Russians now taking strong positions east, west rather, of Guliapolye as well, that the city of Orekhov would also, the town of Orekhov, would also fall and fall fairly quickly, leaving only the city of Zaporozhye under Ukrainian control in Zaporozhye region. So anyway, a major crisis for the Ukrainians there, and we'll see whether it is true that Poltavka has indeed fallen. Further north, there are also reports that the Russians have been making further, gaining further ground in around the village of the big fortified village, actually it's a small town, of Novopavlivka in Dnipropetrovsk region. But I'm going to skip that because this is a complicated battle. And perhaps the more dramatic and important news continues to come from Pokrovsk. Now, we now have video footage that confirms the presence of the Russian military in north and central Pokrovsk, effectively confirming the reports that the whole of western Pokrovsk, including territory north of the railway in Pokrovsk, is under Russian control. Now, yesterday, or maybe it was the day before yesterday, there were also reports that the Russians have captured the industrial sector, the industrial area to the northwest of Pokrovsk as well. And there are also reports that the Russians have pushed north from Pokrovsk itself and have reached the railway, the roads, the main supply road, from the west, and have advanced towards the village of Grishinye from the south, the village that lies immediately to the north of this road. And there are conflicting reports about the situation in the Pokrovska mine that lies a little further to the west, but it looks as if that mine is also about to pass under Russian control and might, of course, have already done so. Now, the point is that if all of these reports are true, and I should say that one of the consistent facts about the Battle of Pokrovsk is that whenever it looks as if we're getting reports from Pokrovsk that speak of bad news for the Ukrainians, it turns out that that bad news does indeed actually turn out to be true. If all of these reports are true, and they probably are, then there is no doubt that we have a massive cauldron in Pokrovsk. Again, I don't know the size of the Ukrainian forces in Pokrovsk. Probably they number several thousand, at least. I know that the Ukrainians at one time had around, I believe it was five Leopard 2 tanks in Pokrovsk. So that perhaps gives us some idea of the quality of the forces that had been deployed by the Ukrainians for the defense of Pokrovsk. But, well, it looks like there is a cauldron, that the Ukrainians are indeed trapped inside Pokrovsk, and that a significant part of this town, maybe half, is already under Russian control. And on the east side, we know that the Russians are now breaking into Mirnograd and are likely capturing more and more parts of it. The Russians also apparently have a strong positions north of Pokrovsk in Rodinska. One can see that the circle around Pokrovsk is now essentially complete. Now, I said previously that Zelensky was in a bad mood and that it's quite plausible that it's news on the battlefronts that is putting him in a bad mood, perhaps more so than the situation, than his issues rather with Donald Trump. And well, if there is a crisis of the kind that I'm describing in Pokrovsk, one can see why that might be. And if the situation in Pokrovsk is as bad as these reports are saying, and as I said, when we get bad reports for the Ukrainians from Pokrovsk, they do tend to turn out to be true, then there is now at least a possibility that Pokrovsk itself will fall before Putin and Trump meet in Budapest, or that if it hasn't yet fallen, that it will be no longer possible to deny that it is about to fall. And that could affect significantly the dynamic of the discussions in Budapest. Anyway, there we go. That is the situation in Pokrovsk. I think this is the single most important part of the battlefronts. To repeat again, the capture of Pokrovsk opens the way for the Russians to advance westwards towards the city of Dnipro on the river, on the Dnieper, but it also opens the way for the Russians to advance north and east to encircle Konstantinovka, to cut the supply roads to Konstantinovka, the southernmost town of the Slavyansk-Kramatorsk Konstantinovka conurbation, where fighting, by the way, is already now taking place. We've had visual proof, apparently, that the Russians are indeed inside Konstantinovka. Anyway, to encircle Konstantinovka and to outflank the Ukrainians in Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, and perhaps take the entire Ukrainian army in Donbass essentially into a cauldron. We are maybe much closer to that point than people realize. Perhaps it's a few months away. Well, we shall see. Anyway, a crisis for the Ukrainians, and one to which, to repeat again, they have no answer. They have no air defence and no possibility now of acquiring air defence. The Patriots have failed, and no more of them are being supplied anyway. The F-16s have failed. They did not make the difference that many people thought they would. The Russians are increasing the scale of their strikes against Ukraine. The number of Garand drones continuously increases. We have numbers of drones numbering into the many hundreds now being launched against Ukraine every night. And apparently, two more giant factories to produce these drones in Russia are coming close to being brought into production as well. The situation where we might have 1,000 drones, Garand drones a night, is no longer so far away. Ukraine looks like it is facing a very cold winter. Temperatures have been falling, and beyond that, there is a crisis in Ukraine's energy system, so that there have been blackouts in Kiev, even on days when the Russians are not attacking the energy system in Kiev itself. And we see this enormous operational crisis develop in Pokrovsk and in Donbass. And well, it looks as if the situation in Kupiansk, which is a smaller place, and we're talking about fewer troops, fewer Ukrainian troops, but that the situation for the Ukrainians in Kupiansk is every bit as critical as it is in Pokrovsk. And in the meantime, the Russians continue to tighten their grip on other places, Liman and Siversk, and even the Ukrainians themselves now acknowledge that the town of Volchansk in Kharkiv region has mostly fallen, and they've had to evacuate large numbers of villages and communities in northeast Kharkiv region, because with the fall of Volchansk and Kharkiv region, it is likely that the Russians will have an unobstructed path to occupying these communities as well. So, to go back to the point I made in this program, Zelensky and the Europeans faced with this situation ought to be welcoming efforts by Trump and perhaps Putin to try to negotiate an end to the conflict in Ukraine. Trump has his own reasons for wanting to end the war in Ukraine, which we've discussed many times. He wants to end it as quickly as possible. He wants to transfer his armies to the east. He wants to try and detach China, Russia from China in some way. He wants all of these various things, and perhaps he also wants the Nobel Prize. Putin wants to end the war in Ukraine because he also still hankers for some kind of relationship with the Americans and understands that he needs the Americans in order to stabilize the situation in Europe on Russia's western border and to renegotiate the security architecture of Europe, which has turned out so negatively, once given that it is NATO dominated, for Russia. But Trump doesn't have to focus on Ukraine all the time. He can deal with other things. I was reading in the Financial Times today about the American plan to overthrow the Maduro government in Venezuela. Apparently, it does not involve an outright invasion of Venezuela. If you believe the Financial Times, which I only do up to a certain degree, the plan seems to be to scare the Venezuelan government into collapse by organizing a massive build-up of American forces around Venezuela. I'm afraid I think it is more complicated than that. But anyway, Trump has other things to think about. He's also got to look at the economic situation in the United States, which some say is becoming increasingly precarious. And of course, he and his administration have to decide how they're going to deal with this massive challenge from China, the one that China has thrown down over rare earths. And as for Putin, well, he probably does still hanker for some kind of long-term understanding with the Americans to stabilize the situation in Europe and to secure Russia's western border. But he must be asking himself what others in Russia are increasingly asking: is this ever realistically going to happen? And besides, given that we're on the brink of winning the war, why waste time with this anyway? So it's far from guaranteed that Putin will stick to this course also. In fact, to repeat what I've said, if Budapest doesn't work, then it's quite likely, in fact, it's very likely, that even Putin will say, enough's enough, let's focus on winning the war instead. Let's exclusively focus on winning the war instead. So, given that Ukraine is losing the war, given that Zelensky has, in theory, far and away the most to lose, you would think that he would be the one who would be pushing for a peace most. And you would have thought that he would have the strong support of the Europeans also to do it. Well, I don't get any sense of that at all. I get the sense, on the contrary, that Zelensky remains as opposed to a negotiated resolution of the war, except, of course, on his terms, as ever, and that the Europeans are the same. It doesn't look as if we're going to get a peace, and that is the reality, and it is the reality we must all face. Well, this is where I finish today's program. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.